we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense? In which we look at the deeper second stories. Those are the ones that have got context, the rationale, the conflicts that exist when we do normal work. The stuff that often gets brushed under the carpet because it's too difficult or people don't even go looking for it. And that's the purpose of this podcast. And today I've got Christian Gould, who I met last year and gave a really powerful presentation about a ship colliding with another ship. And this made a lot of media impression for a whole bunch of different reasons. And it was a brilliant story told to understand that second piece. So before we get into the first story and the second story, Christian, who are you? How did you get to where you are? What do you do? And where can people find you both in the real world and the virtual space? And we'll put contact details in the show notes.
Sure. All right. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. So I live in beautiful Oslo, Norway, where I work for a company named Equinor. I'll be talking on behalf of myself and not the company today in this podcast. But it's an energy company, both in oil and gas, but also renewable energy. Apart from that, I've been working in that industry as well as with other industries like the maritime sector as a human factors professional for more than 20 years. And I have been a researcher previously. I did research for the Norwegian Navy. I have also worked as a practitioner with human factors and in engineering. And most recently, the last 3 or 4 years, I've been working with integrating human organizational performance principles in our organization as well as across industry here in Norway. So that's me.
Excellent. And have you got an email address that people can get hold of you on?
I do, but it's probably easiest just to send me a message on LinkedIn.
Via LinkedIn.
We'll
hook your connection for that. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. And one of the bits that, you know, you mentioned about being a researcher, I think that when you gave your presentation to us at Lund University, was actually, it's just as in many situations, this is not unusual. And the problems that were encountered in this particular situation were sort of known about. So tell us the first story then, Christian. What's the bit that sort of hits the media and comes across as that sort of simple linear approach to what happened in this case?
Sure. All right. So the story that I'll be talking about is about a Norwegian Navy frigate named Helgingstad, which was rather new, that was on its way back to base from an exercise off Scotland, and on its way back to base, an oil tanker was on its way out, leaving one of our terminals. At the time, the frigate was not aware of this tanker that was on its way out. There was some misperception of the situation, some miscommunication, and it ended up with a collision between the frigate and the tanker. The first thing that's important to note is that fortunately this did not result in any loss of life or significant environmental damage. It did result in a total loss of the frigate, which was significant enough in itself, but I would argue that it was only chance that separated this from becoming a much worse incident, because there were 137 people on board. The accident, it happened at 4 a.m. So most of the crew members on the frigate, they were resting at the time. Also probably worth noting that Norway has conscription, so quite a few of these crew members were quite young, late teens, early 20s. Mm-hmm. And obviously the tanker being fully loaded, if that would have ended up in a full rupture, you know, it would have meant significant environmental damage. So the collision resulted in the hull of the frigate being damaged. It took in water. There was some question as to the remaining stability of the frigate, so they ended up grounding it, where it then listed. But they were able to evacuate, and then so everyone made it out safely.
Excellent.
It was a pretty significant event here. This happened in November 2018, so it's starting to be a little while ago.
Yeah.
But I'd say that it's still a fairly significant event in the maritime sector here in Norway.
Yeah, and the sort of the media imagery of, you know, professionals grounding a vessel on the side, and the sort of, it's all out there. And mm-hmm. it's an interesting, because just as you were talking about this, thinking about the resilience within the system, yes, there was certainly some luck involved when we look at this, but thinking about the tanker, the designs of those, the fact that the crew of the frigate were able to ground it and get people off. So it's that bit of, where do we classify fail safely in this situation? You lost the vessel and a lot of money that was sunk into that, no pun intended, but actually we didn't lose any lives and we didn't have any major catastrophic ecological disasters like we could have done. So, So tell us about the second story, because I think when you recounted your story, you're like anybody who's passionate about something, because you've got a deep knowledge, as I am in the diving space, as to how people behave the way they do. It's mm-hmm. not just simple, they weren't paying attention. There wasn't, you know, clear communication. They should have done better at what they do. And you told a really engaging, long second story to say, actually, you know, this, you could say, is not a surprise, given the conditions and the context in which this activity took place. So,
yeah, sure. So, I think the first thing I want to say about that is that there really was only one thing that was unique about that accident, and that was the outcome, mm-hmm. being so severe as it was. And the reason I'm saying that is that, navigation accidents in the Norwegian Navy, they had happened on a number of occasions previously with frigates, but also with other types of vessels. And the conditions that were seen in those accidents that had much smaller consequences, material damage typically, or somebody having some bruises, those conditions were the same conditions as the investigation found in this accident. So I think it's quite important to note that these conditions, they were not novel. There was really little that was sort of unique about that situation in itself, apart from the outcome. I know this because I did a study as part of my PhD where we looked at 35 accidents over slightly less than 20-year period, where we looked at, you know, performance shaping factors that had been involved in those accidents. Those same performance shaping factors had, you know, they'd also been there when things were going well. So it's probably important to note that there really wasn't that much that was unique to this specific night when that accident happened. But the attention given to an accident is obviously proportionate to the consequences. So since the consequences were huge here, you know, first of all, obviously there was a lot of attention around the outcome. for good reason. Many of the crew members who had been aboard the frigate, they were deeply affected by this. Many of them were close to losing their life, you know. And it's also worth noting that there was a lot of surprise around how was this possible, and that surprise is probably linked to the fact that it was a clear night, the weather was fine. A lot of attention was given also to the fact that the frigate was only 9 years old. It was a fairly new frigate. Mm-hmm. So a lot of talk about this being a technologically advanced vessel. So
should be able to see the other vessel in the area.
Absolutely. Yes. And as you often see in the media, you know, you'll have sort of a sort of binary distinction between this being a technical issue or a human issue. And since they could rule out this not being a technical issue, you know, you very, very quickly focused on the fact that this must be related to human error. So that word popped up rather quickly. Mm-hmm. And then a formal investigation was started. I was not part of that. I want to make that clear. Just prior to this accident, there had been established a military investigation board. In addition to that, Norway has an accident investigation board, which at the time did not include the military, but was responsible for civilian transportation. There needed to be some coordination between them around the investigation, but it was quickly sort of established that this accident had to do with human factors and decision making and a lot of those things. So
just like nearly everyone that's out there, in fact,
like almost anything. Yeah, I would argue probably 100%.
Yes,
And then, you know, they went forward with their investigation and really put a lot of effort into it. And that meant that the investigation report, it wasn't ready. As far as I remember, it was probably around a year after the accident. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't any, you know, talk about the accident in the meantime. So independent of the investigation, there was a lot of commentary, both in the media, but also on like social media. You had a lot of opinion pieces being written by people from the civilian shipping sector, by people from other industries, and I probably would argue that much of that was quite blame focused. And I would say that there was a lot of stereotyping going on. And one thing that you could especially see was that this being an accident involving the Navy, you could quickly see that people from the civilian part of shipping, they saw this as being a naval issue, not a general maritime issue.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting listening. And I've written a couple of pieces down here. One I'll come on to in a minute about learning and process safety and background, but the other one was about the Washington DC crash with the Black Hawk and the regional jet collision. And when they talk about the flying hours for the Army air crew of between sort of 500 and 1,000 hours, people are like, what are they doing flying in such densely populated areas with so few hours? And you sit there going, it's not the hours, it's the quality of the hours that are there. Mm-hmm. But it's an immediate piece of, you know, and then there's this, the visual acuity issue of being able to spot lights in the background of a sea of lights, which, you know, is one of the things that I believe comes out of this. Is,
possibly some similarities between those two accidents, probably on that topic. Yeah. I would just speculate, can you see the threat?
It's that bit of human performance in a confused visual environment you can't identify the threat. So sorry I interrupt you. Carry on, Christine.
No, that's fine. Yeah. So in the media and on the internet, a lot of debate, a lot of speculation. And from the Navy itself, not a lot of information coming out from there. I mean, because they were obviously reluctant to say much since there was an investigation going on. That is quite understandable. But there were a couple colleagues of the crew who did voice some concern that people were being quite judgmental on an unfair ground. And that, it's worth noting that was probably the exception more than the rule. Yeah. There was a lot of talk about, you know, how could this be possible, both in terms of the crew itself, but also how could it be possible for the Navy to allow this practice to happen? Then after a year, the investigation report, or the first part of the investigation report, was published. There were two investigation reports, where the first one looked at the time up until the collision itself, and the second report focused more on the emergency response activities following the collision. The first part of the report was focused on the sequence of events, the narrative from the frigate approaching the coast, sailing into this vessel traffic service area, where they communicated with a vessel traffic service operator, who at first did not pick up that they were entering this area, later on remembered it, and who then coordinated with the tanker that they collided with, where there was a marine pilot on board who was, you know, not legally, but probably by all practical purposes, conducting most of the navigation on the way out from this terminal. So the narrative.
So this is about 3 o'clock in the morning, 3-4 o'clock in the morning at this stage.
Right.
So circadian rhythms are pretty low.
Right. So there were all these kinds of issues, and only a few minutes or 8 minutes before the collision, there was a shift handover where the officer of the watch was relieved by another officer of the watch. This handover was done normally. It was done by the radar, where they focus on what other vessels were present in the area. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there you have many vessels that were stationary compared to some that were in traffic, and this picture that was established was one that did not include much focus on the tanker that they actually hit, because that was shown with a passive AIS symbol. Mm-hmm. And then, as the report establishes, the time margin to collision becomes much lower. The frigate is sailing with darkened lanterns. Mm-hmm. They have their AIS in passive mode. That was normal practice at the time for military craft. And then as they're approaching, the VTS and the tanker with the pilot become aware of the frigate approaching. They try to notify the frigate using both this Aldous lamp as well as by radio. The frigate misinterpret that. They don't see the lamp, and they misinterpret the radio communication as coming from a different vessel that they think is calling them up. And then,
the tanker was full on light. So you might be pressing a light button to signal.
They used a flashlight, which is a last resort type of communication. Mm-hmm. And this was not seen because of background lighting. And then they only saw the tanker. I think it was about 30 seconds before they hit. So they had no time to maneuver around it. And then it ended the way it did. So just to try to summarize at least some of the factors that were emphasized in the investigation report, things like, time of day, this was 4 a.m., circadian rhythm effects, experience was an issue. This being a naval vessel meant that you had fairly inexperienced crew members, some of them being conscripts on the bridge. You had issues with crew resource management. You had issues with communication, both sort of within the team on the bridge, but also between the vessels. You had some issues with background lighting, making it difficult to sort of distinguish stationary objects from those in motion. You had issues with visual acuity. There were a lot of things that were brought up. And again,
that blooming effect where, you know, it's sort of 30 seconds to go is based on the speed, but how quickly something gets very large, very quickly, depending on your own speed. And that bit of, it's now something as opposed to a stationary object, the relative movement.
Makes it clearer. And it's probably worth noting there that the frigate, you know, they had established that there was something there, but they didn't think that it was a tanker and they didn't think that it was in motion. So, so there was a typical sort of misinterpretation of the situation, what some might call a situation awareness issue. But I think it's probably best to sort of try to summarize it as a situation where what they thought to be the situation was not the actual situation. And that
made sense at the time, which is what we're, you know, this whole podcast is about.
It made sense at the time to do what they did. And the decisions that they were making, they were rational given the way they saw the situation. They were probably also rational based on the way they normally would sail these frigates and in many cases also with people who had more experience than this person who was there. But anyway, this whole thing ended up in this investigation report where it wasn't only, you know, the frigate and the crew members there that were sort of highlighted as being contributing to this. Mm-hmm. Also the tanker, you know, they had flood lit the front deck for good reason. That's for the safety of the deckhands. But that made it difficult to see. And then finally, obviously, the vessel traffic service, which played a part in especially probably reducing the time margin until they were able to notice that there was something else there. Mm-hmm. So that was the investigation. And from the investigation report was published, it took another 3 or so years before they decided to prosecute the officer of the watch on the frigate. So the military was given a statutory fine, which they accepted, but then later on they decided to run a criminal case against the officer of the watch. And there he was tried for negligence, both according to military statutes as well as according to criminal, but sort also of civilian, sort of, civilian navigation statutes. And there, that case was tried both in the lower court, where he was given a 60-day suspended sentence, and that was appealed to an appellate court, where that was upheld. In the appellate court, I testified on his behalf, so I was kind of involved in the case there. But in both cases, you know, it was kind of interesting to see the contrast between sort of a legal framing of a situation like this compared to the way you would frame it from a safety or a learning point of view.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the bits that because I spend so much time trying to focus on the near misses and the close calls that are there, where we don't have a serious injury or a fatality and the legal system gets engaged. As soon as anything serious happens, especially in the diving space, it becomes a litigation issue. And as soon as the litigation happens, the stories stop for a whole variety of reasons. And that is that bit that said, look, we don't have to have accidents to create learning environments. You've got to go out there and find those stories. Without having that, because once you're in the legal space, most bets are off when it comes to learning, because you end up with a closed down situation like you described.
So it was interesting, and I have to say that it was probably a little bit depressing too, because, I mean, something happens to people when they go to court, that's for sure. And, it's definitely not a sort of a safe space, you know? So, since you had multiple parties involved here who were sort of contributing to the accident, obviously it became paramount for them to sort of reduce their own culpability. That meant that there was a lot of pointing, and there was only one person who was prosecuted. That's important. So, you know, so the role of the court is only one thing, and that is to assess whether the person who's being prosecuted is guilty or not. So, so that meant that, you know, a lot of the questions, they became about him and his qualifications, his competence, his personality. And obviously there, the question came up that, you know, he was qualified for the job. He had his certificates in order. His superior said that he would not have gone to sleep if he hadn't felt safe, that this person wasn't competent to do the job. And that basically, by legal standards, meant that he was assumed to be negligent here. Yeah. And obviously that's not unproblematic, because, again, it made sense to him. And many of these conditions that that reduced his performance or impeded his performance, you know, they're normal, and they were known, and they'd been, you know, and they'd been reported to the Navy, and they didn't really do that much about them until after the accident. They made significant improvements after the accident. They made changes to the amount of time it took to qualify new navigators. They made changes to use of AIS. They did all kinds of things. But it's I guess it's a normal thing that you have to wait for consequences to be severe before these things get prioritized.
I think it's Edda Henriksen in one of his papers just talks about you need a politically relevant event to create change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard piece. A number of years ago, I was involved in an investigation, and I sat there with a sort of convening people, and I said, look, if this person hadn't died, I wouldn't be here.
No.
But you would still have all of the latent issues that are here. And this comes back to something that I wrote down early on when you talked about these known conditions, and you've just talked about just now, is we need to have something go bang before we do something about it. It's this gradual erosion of the margin, the capacity we've got. And there's a post yesterday by a guy called Bruce Webb, and I'll put it in the show notes, but he was one of the survivors. The post was talking about the erosion of safety margins in the oil and gas industry and a presentation that took place a few days ago, just saying, look, all of the precursors that led to Piper Alpha are now in place. And now we're basically getting to the stage where we have low levels of competence and experience, high pressures in terms of commercial viability. All of the conditions that are there, were there, are now here.
And we're sitting there going, I don't know if I entirely agree with that line of reasoning. I mean, certainly safety standards are far more stringent today than they were at the time of Piper Alpha, as well as many safeguards that are now engineered into our offshore assets. They are also worth noting, both in terms of the integrity and the layout and the design, but also in terms of fail-safe mechanisms that you now have. So I think he might be right about, you know, some things, but in the whole, I don't know if I agree. I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's cool. So, you know, the general bit was around about the erosion of the margins that we've got.
Yeah.
And going back to
Ingstad, I mean, that issue in itself is kind of interesting, because, you know, one thing that became quite central to the discussion around the case was, you know, why did you have such inexperienced crew members on the bridge at the time? And, you know, and that issue is probably in some part linked to a fundamental goal conflict that the Navy had here in Norway. And that was that, you know, they were struggling with one issue from the time these frigates were delivered until the accident, and that was that many of these ships, they weren't sailing as much as they should be. And that issue was, at least in some part, linked to personnel shortages. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that personnel was often personnel that the oil and gas industry in Norway desperately needed. You know, these were mm-hmm. people with expertise.
Okay, yeah, so in, the recruiting piece,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and gas turbines, propulsion systems, underwater robotics, mm-hmm. you know, all these things. And you know, and that ran against an expectation from, you know, from the government that you would have to meet mm-hmm. KPIs on sailing hours, yeah. all these things. So yeah, so that's a good example, I think, of eroding margins. Yeah,
and that just triggers something that I was at a commercial diving conference at the tail end of last year, and it was mainly inland inshore divers. Mm-hmm. So they really struggle because of developing experience and competence and longevity of the divers, because they are in effect feeders for the offshore diving sector. Mm-hmm. So when the offshore sector is quiet, the inshore sector is full, and when the offshore sector picks up, everybody goes over
yeah,
here.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And now you're left with the inexperienced people to still do some pretty difficult jobs inshore.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, how do we manage this? How do we invest in our divers? Mm-hmm. Because if the market picks up and they go elsewhere, we've lost that capability. Sure. So this is an interesting trade, and I've just talked in a previous podcast about business risk and safety risk.
Yeah. But again, you know, the name of your podcast is How Did It Make Sense? And I want to make one thing clear, that it probably made sense to you know, the heads of the Norwegian Navy to go ahead with this. Because when you talk about things like experience, it can be hard to draw a hard line as to what is experienced enough, what is too inexperienced. You know, that's not a black or white issue.
Oh, absolutely.
And obviously, when you've experienced that this is safe enough and people are capable of doing this work, you know, there isn't that much that suggests that you should be doing something different, especially when you have conflicting goals. So, mm-hmm. so it's important for me that, you know, we're not when we're talking about learning is not about sort of shifting blame one level up.
Yes.
It's also about understanding
how the system behaves.
And why. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when I talk about that, you know, how does it make sense in the local rationality? It's not just the sharp end, those who are faced with the hazard. Mm-hmm. It is all those people throughout the organizations and, you know, the middle managers who have got the worst conflicting goals to deal with, where they've got senior leadership coming down saying, this is the organizational pressure and the goals we've got to do. And then there's the stuff coming up saying, this is how we manage safety. How do we trade those off?
It's true. Yeah. You know, sometimes in safety, we talk about having like a vision zero. You know, we want to envision zero incidents, zero harm, you know, that kind of thing. And that's fine, especially zero harm, I think, is a worthwhile goal. You know, zero fatalities, zero life-changing injuries, that's definitely a goal we should have. But sometimes when I talk to, you know, executives, I'll ask them, you know, why don't we have a vision zero for bad business decisions? Why don't we have a vision zero for bad investments, bad, you know, that kind of
recruiting
stuff.
Recruiting or whatever, yeah.
Whatever,
exactly.
Yeah. And the issue is kind of the same sometimes, because, you know, if you were to make only, you know, surefire decisions when it comes to business decisions, you probably wouldn't be making many decisions at all, or at least you wouldn't be making many bets. You know, so there's always an element of uncertainty involved, and there's always the potential that you might be wrong. And obviously in this case, we're talking about a severe accident. Some of the assumptions that were mm-hmm. assumed, you know, that were thought to be there, they turned out to be wrong, mm-hmm. and that had a bad impact. But going back to the story, I mean, the issue here was very much focused around him as an individual, and it was mm-hmm. it was kind of interesting to note when you read the verdict that they make it clear that things like fatigue, inexperience, crew members around him on the bridge who weren't offering as much support mm-hmm. as they possibly could have, lighting being difficult, you know, that kind of stuff. It was made fairly clear that those issues, they were not significant enough to sort of absolve him of not being considered negligent, because negligent or sort of attention and negligence was sort of pointed at as being the key issue. And that is, I guess, probably where you can see the biggest contrast between sort of legal framing of work in this kind of setting compared to a decision-making setting.
And as I understand it, the maritime law is so old.
Yeah.
And that's what's used a lot of the time. When that law was set up, mm-hmm. you know, decades, 100 years ago, it was a pretty simple system in which people were operating, a pretty linear setup. Whereas now we're dealing with so many different pieces of information.
Yeah.
All of the stuff that's there, those performance shaping factors, but we still expect the human to perform to the same level of competence
absolutely.
In a simple linear system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you have some ideas still circulating around the responsibility of the master or the captain, which I would argue probably are grounded in centuries-old traditions that probably don't always make sense to the same degree today in terms of how modern ships are operated. But yeah, so.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Christian. That's really, really insightful. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's out there. And I would say, as you sort of alluded to, when you observe, read, or take in that information, consider also the local rationality of the person that's producing that narrative. And the media's narrative is about selling stuff. The opinion people, it's about their voice. And the more contentious you can be, the more popular you are, and then you become more engaged. So think about the local rationality of everybody that's involved in telling a story too. So the final piece is sort of book, paper, video, or multiple versions that you would recommend others have a look at or read, consume, and maybe shaped your past. So one or two things, and I'll put those in the show notes too.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the sort of topics that I'm really interested in is decision making. And many of your listeners probably have heard of, you know, thinking fast and slow, and heard mention of, you know, biases, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. While that framework does have validity in some settings, in situations like navigation or diving or many other sort of operational contexts, I would say that naturalistic decision making is probably a framework that makes a lot more sense and that has a lot more explanatory value, both in terms of looking back at things that have happened, as well as in terms of developing capabilities to prevent things from happening or manage situations that happen. And that's where I would really recommend reading publications by Gary Klein and his collaborators. He has a book named Streetlights and Shadows, which I really think is a great book. And if you look at some of those sort of more secondary literature around that, there's a book called Working Minds by Beth Crandall and others that gives a lot of great guidance on critical incident techniques, other various types of sort of cognitive task analysis that sort of links in natural decision making frameworks to more applied approaches that can be used for learning. That's probably where I would really recommend that. You can see some of that being put into use. You know, like John Allspaugh, he has developed some great guidelines for incident learning. I think that's still up from Etsy. You can see a lot of that sort of naturalistic decision making approach being invoked there. I don't know, Gareth, is it if it's allowed to promote your own stuff? Can you do that here on this podcast? Yeah.
Go for it. Your Nordsk stuff for Hawk.
Right. I would also probably like to mention the work that we've done through the Federation of Norwegian Industries, where we have developed a human organizational performance guideline called Safety, Leadership, and Learning. That is available for free on their website in both Norwegian and in English. And I don't know when this podcast will be released, but it will soon be available in English in a second edition. So, yeah.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So this will be about 4 or 5 weeks' time from now.
It should be out by then. Yep.
Cool. That's brilliant. It's a really cool guide. It's about 75, 80 pages from what I can remember.
Yep.
And goes through in real practical terms what those principles mean, how you apply them, and the differences you can get. So, the links to National Institute of Decision Making and John Osfor's Blame-Free Postmortems, really good stuff. So I'll put the links in there. Christian, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great being
invited. For you, working day. And we'll go from there. And hopefully we'll catch up with you at Lund or somewhere else around the world.
Yeah, it'll be good. Okay.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. All right. Bye.